Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK. A-OK.
Hey everyone, new episodes of Little Known Facts drop every Monday and you can find them on your favorite podcast provider. Also, if you go to the website, littleknownfactspodcast.com, you'll find behind-the-scenes photos, videos, and interviews, and lots more on the gallery page. And if you are loving these intimate, candid conversations with all the artists who come on the show, please head over to the contributions page. I depend on these donations to continue to bring you these interviews every week. So if you love the show, please donate. Little known fact about my guest today. His Broadway Bears burlesque revue raises money for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS, an organization that supports people diagnosed and living with HIV. In his first year, my guest and seven of his friends danced on a New York City bar and raised $8,000. To date, Broadway Bears has now raised over $17.4 million for Broadway Cares. You too can show you care by going to BroadwayCares.org and making a donation. And now, welcome Jerry Mitchell.
A-OK. A-OK.
Hey, everyone. My guest today is the multi-Tony Award-winning Broadway director and choreographer, Jerry Mitchell. With a career that spans over three decades, Jerry began it all as a Broadway dancer and went on to become one of the most sought-after artists working in the musical theater today. He either wins or is nominated for a Tony Award for every project he touches. On Broadway, he has directed and choreographed On Your Feet, Kinky Boots, and Legally Blonde, and often works all around the world. He was the sole choreographer for Catch Me If You Can, Never Gonna Dance, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Gypsy, The Rocky Horror Show, The Full Monty, and You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. His work can be seen on film in Hedwig and the Angry Inch, Scent of a Woman, In and Out, and Camp, among others, and he choreographed the NBC live production of Hairspray. He's helped to raise tremendous amounts of money for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS with his show Broadway Bears. And I'm so happy to welcome to the podcast my dear old friend, Jerry Mitchell.
Little known facts. I'm so happy to be here.
I can't believe it. I can't believe it. You're one of the few people who would understand why this show is called Little Known Facts.
Yes.
So the thing that is truly inspirational about being around you, and this is true probably for people just listening to your voice or people who have had the opportunity to be near you or work with you, is that I've never met someone who wakes up every day and comes in with such joy. So whether that's true or you're one of the best actors in the world, I like to think, because I'm married to someone from the Midwest, that there might be something about, like, growing up in Paw Paw, Michigan,
yeah,
that you've brought with you to the big city.
Definitely. I mean, I dreamed of being here, but when I look back and think about where I was raised and the kind of family that raised me, my parents, my father's still around, my mom's gone now, but not just my parents, my grandparents on both sides, and my aunts and uncles and all of those people, I was raised with a very positive outlook, probably mostly from my mother and father and my grandparents, and a pretty balanced democratic outlook.
Well, that's happy making. So it sounds to me, in my idealized version, romanticized version of it, it's like a teeny town where everybody super knows teeny. Each other.
Mm-hmm. And everybody knows everybody's business.
Is your name your name? Were you Jerry Mitchell growing up?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So did everyone know the Mitchells?
Yes. My grandparents had a bar. My grandparents on my father's side had a bar called the Friendly Tavern.
Okay.
Enough
said.
Or called the Friendly Place. And then when my grandmother died, when Grandma Mitchell died, and Grandpa Mitchell was already gone when I was very young, but Grandma Mitchell died. My mom and dad took it over. My mom was working there already. My dad took it over, and it became Gene Mitchell's The Friendly Place.
Unbelievable. Wait, did your parents grow up together in this town?
They did, in Pawpaw. My mom was born and raised there. My dad, I think, was born in Chicago, but my grandmother then, she sent him to Pawpaw to live with cousins because he was acting up in Chicago, and then she moved there with the bar because she had a bar in the south side of Chicago, Polish. That's the Polish side of the family.
So you're part Polish. What is your other?
My mom's side of the family.
Let's do a DNA test right now. I just need a swab.
My grandfather came from Sicily.
Okay.
With his sister and brother. They were in New York and Detroit. My aunt worked here in the sweatshops.
Is this on your mom's side?
On my mom's side.
Do you know what their last name was?
Misuraca and Cusimano. And so they lived in Long Island, and she worked here in New York in the sweatshops. She was a seamstress, a great seamstress. My grandfather went to Michigan with his brother, Dominic, and they lived and grew up in Detroit and then settled in Pawpaw. And my grandfather actually was a winemaker. He made one of the first, built one of the first wineries, the Pawpaw Wine Company in Pawpaw. Pawpaw now has 6 or 7 wineries.
And really?
It has a grape and wine festival. My grandfather was very, very involved in the politics in my little hometown community. He was a very smart immigrant. He owned a lot of property. And we grew up in the Misuraca subdivision, which was behind the winery, and all of my relatives lived there. They all had houses.
When you say
houses.
A subdivision, so houses.
It's like, okay. Yeah, houses all in a circle that my grandfather plotted out.
Amazing.
And, you know, when he passed away, it was very interesting because he was very much about the community, which is, we can get into later, but it's why I think Broadway Bears happened for me because I'm about the community.
Sure.
And I really learned that from him. And he had all of this land. And when he passed away, or when my mom passed away, actually, about 5 or 6 years ago, we were going through all the office papers that had been dusted
right.
and down there forever. I found the land plots. He was giving acres of land away for a penny to families that needed a place to build a house. And I thought, wow. And those plots in the subdivision, like I found a map, and he has names written in them and who he gave the land to. And he, when I was a kid, he had about 200 acres, a farm, asparagus, rhubarb, tomatoes. He grew everything. Grapes, we picked all of that stuff. We harvested it. My aunts were in the yard peeling tomatoes and making spaghetti sauce. I mean, and then he would bottle that and ship that around. He was quite a businessman.
Wow, that is incredible. Also, just that idea of when I really think about what it would be to go to a place where I don't really know the language, to come and sort of make your way and figure it all out and then just be so generous in that way. It's kind of extraordinary. Now, did they use the stuff that they farmed to cook in the restaurant?
Well, my
or those two different sides of the family.
Two different sides of the family.
Okay.
Although my Italian side also had a little restaurant, but they got rid of that right away when the wine company was opened.
And did you grow up going to Friendly's and hanging out there?
I spent my life in the bar. Basically, I was 5. All of us, I have 2 older brothers. We all grew up in the bar. And my grandmother, my grandma Mitchell, and my mom, one of the greatest things both sides of the family taught me was if I wanted a dollar, there was something to be done for it. So they taught me to work for a dollar. And usually that work was in the bar or around the bar. So when I was a kid, every Sunday, we were cleaning the bar, my brothers and I. We would go there and we'd chat our jobs. Now, I was 5 or 6 when I started. And my first
job— Are you the youngest?
I'm the youngest. And my first job, I had a bucket, a bar rag, and a putty knife. And I'd crawl under each table, scrape the gum off the bottom of the table into the bucket, take the bleach rag and wipe the bottom of the table and the you know, the thing that holds the table
right,
up in
the base, yeah.
Wipe the whole thing off and do that for all the bar tables. That was the first job at 5 years old. $5 and all the beef jerky I wanted. My grandmother would give me.
Delicious.
And then I graduated to polishing the copper bar rail, which was a much harder job. You needed some muscle.
Sure.
Put the brasso on it, let it dry, and then polish it off so that thing shines.
I'm smelling it.
Yeah.
Like as you do it.
And your hands smelled like
totally.
And I did it every Sunday. And then I learned to cook. I learned to pour draft beers at an age when you weren't supposed to pour draft
no
beers.
Yeah, no child labor laws.
Finally
in Pawpaw.
Got to like mopping and sweeping the floors. But I literally worked in that place from the youngest days I can remember until I left town at 17. I was always working at the bar.
Now, I'm also imagining you like using the bar as a ballet bar. Were you also like and point and flex? Like, when did unbelievable dancer.
I actually danced more in our living room.
Okay.
But usually when everybody was gone, we had a big picture window. And at night, it kind of reflected you. So it was my mirror. The picture window in our family. Like, nobody knows this really. I maybe told my brothers, but literally when they were out of the house, I would use the mirror as my picture. I mean, the picture window as my mirror and dance in front of the picture window. Now the neighbors must have been seeing me across the street going, what the hell is that boy doing in there?
It's like actually a two-way mirror, Jerry.
flying through the living room.
And I don't even want to know what you were wearing when you were doing it. So were you like a kid listening to Broadway cast albums, or was like, what were you dancing to?
It's funny. I wasn't bitten by the bug till I was about 10. We had a community theater and I went with my next door neighbor, Amy Firestone.
Who'd been watching you through the window.
She was in the show. Well, okay. She was my best friend, and I went to her dance class when she was younger, and I learned to dance by watching her.
You mean you'd like hang out while she had class?
I'd watch her take class, and then I'd come home and I'd teach her the steps. I didn't take them. I'd just watch.
You were right.
But it was basic. It was basic tap and baton, and she was not very good. And I would learn it, and then I'd show her. And then
I feel like I've seen this
and
show.
And then like I was very Billy Elliot. And then I was 10, and I got involved in the Village Players because of her and the Music Man. And the choreographer was the local dance teacher. And this is very Billy Elliot. She would invite me to come take dance classes, and I wouldn't go because it was all girls, and I didn't want anybody to know I was gay, you know, at that age. And although I knew I was. And so then eventually I was riding home from football practice, racing my best friend Pat Warner, and he was on a Solex, and I was on a 10-speed, chain busted, and I went over the handlebars and broke my collarbone. And so I took dance class at 15. I couldn't play football. My excuse was, I'll take class to keep my legs in shape for basketball.
Right. That's right. It's like rehab.
It was rehab.
Right. Physical therapy.
So I went to dance class. And of course, when I got there, she was so smart. At the time, I didn't think about this, but when she was so smart, because I literally was the only guy in the class, she gave me all my classes for free and paid me to come on Saturday mornings for 3 hours and teach basic tap to 5, 6, and 7-year-old girls.
And then
toe
she was
step,
also like,
toe step.
If you could get the gum off the bottom of the table and do a
So
little,
she literally put the hook in my mouth. And then I remember when I graduated from high school, she was at my graduation. And by now, you know, I danced for 3 years with her and learned every kind of move except ballet. I had no ballet. So I said, thank you for teaching me how to dance. And she said, I didn't teach you how to dance. It was always in you. I just brought it out. And I was like, wah, 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 wah. You know, because that's really true. She gave me a place to express myself physically, which I didn't have. I didn't have that place.
Right, or vocabulary for it. So did you also play football at the same time?
I played all sports the whole time.
You did? So you were Jock City.
I played sports all the time. My brothers did. And I love sports. I think sports actually helped my dancing, and my dancing helped my sports. So I think that's true what they say. That's the same physical activity, and they help your coordination. And senior year, I was in my senior year 2 weeks in, and I got asked to tour the United States in a production of West Side Story with the Young Americans. So I left school. I left my senior year. Now
Were they scouting? Like, you were in Pawpaw, Michigan.
They were in Kalamazoo on a break.
Performing
at the Miller Auditorium. Okay. I saw some of the kids who I had worked in summer theater with, And the young Americans have their home in Petoskey, Michigan. So they were starting their tour in Michigan. I happened to be there. I happened to see a couple kids. They said one of the dancers had hurt himself, might have to leave the tour. Come back with us. Milton Anderson's there, who runs the Young Americans. Dance for him. I literally danced in the lobby, no music, jumping around. And he said, can you join us? And this was like a Thursday. On Sunday, we're leaving. And I went home bawling because my parents always stressed education first, education first.
Right.
And I went home and I like said, you know, this is an opportunity I want to take. And they said, go to school tomorrow and ask your principal if you can do it and still graduate. And if you can, we'll let you go. And, you know, my mom's bawling and my dad's going, oh, my God, what's happening? And I went to school and the principal said, well, of course you have to do this. And now I had all of my requirements to graduate except for government. That was the only thing I needed to take one semester. So I went on tour and kept records and took a journal and they gave me credit. And then I came back, took the government exam, passed and graduated my class. Actually, the day I came back, it was April, I think, or maybe early May. There were like 6 weeks left. My best friend in high school, Andy Hamry, who I did all my sports with, kept my number for the track team. Because I'd gotten my varsity letter when I was a freshman. I high jumped in a high hurdle. They kept my number. The day I got back, the next day, I went to an international meet at Western Michigan University, and I got like third in high jump and second in high hurdles. And I did the whole season of track and went to state and graduated.
Okay.
Just boom.
Okay.
Boom. It was done.
First of all. It's so amazing. Every name you've just said, I want to write down because I can't even, like my next novel, the name just, like Amy, and every single name is like, you can't make it up. Like they're the most specific.
It's a small town.
It's a small town. But also, Jerry, you've just told this story of your high school senior year as if it happened yesterday, right? Like that's, yeah. I mean, you're a very young man and maybe, and obviously it only happened a few years ago, but still like for it to be right
clear.
There is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And also, I talk about this a lot on the show about sort of that Malcolm Gladwell thing of the most successful people, when they sort of track it, and not to a person, had like this lucky thing happen.
Yeah.
And at least 10,000 hours
yeah.
doing the thing that the lucky break was for.
Well, you know, I always say that. I say that
yeah.
there is no good luck or bad luck. There's opportunity and there's if you're prepared, you're going to have a very lucky day.
Yeah.
And if you're not prepared when the knock comes, you're going to have an unlucky day.
And because you danced in your living room at night when no one was home, you could do it in the lobby.
You
that
never know when that knock's going to come.
Exactly.
You know, you never know. And I think, you know, when I meet a lot of young people who get discouraged because they have a bad audition, and I speak to a lot of young people, I always try to emphasize with them, you don't know. I'm sitting behind the table at Bernie Telsey's, and you're auditioning for me for a musical, but I have six more musicals on my dance card. And I often write on the picture, and I pass it to Bernie and say, they're right for this one. Call them in for this one. They may not be right for this one. So the audition process isn't just about what you're there for. It could be for a lot of things. And don't forget, Bernie Telsey, they cast 9,000 musicals.
Right,
you know?
Literally.
So, literally.
Today.
So,
yeah.
So you know, you're auditioning for a lot of stuff, not just specifically what you're in the
right.
room auditioning
I
for.
I know. The heartbreak is that you're so in the dark so
of
much
course.
Of the time.
And you don't
there's
get
no
the
time.
Feedback. And you
right.
don't get the
there's
feedback.
There's no time. It's
yeah.
like, okay.
Yeah.
I know, because it's so funny. Sometimes I even have to research more for people I actually know so that
yeah.
it doesn't just stay about like, oh, my God,
yeah.
and I miss you and let's catch
yeah.
up. And I watched some of the Legally Blonde reality show
yeah.
that you guys did. And I felt like that there was sort of a toughness to you in that director persona that was – not as familiar to me
as nothing real in reality TV.
So I think we need to break it
yeah.
down because
there's
I think people
real.
Watch
okay.
these things.
Here's
and I'm here to say that Jerry Mitchell is the nicest, warmest, sweetest, most supportive human on the planet.
Here's how a reality TV show works.
Tell
I've
me.
Done two.
Okay, we want to know.
The first one I did was with Elizabeth Berkley. It was called Step It Up and Dance for Bravo and Magical Elves. And they were one.
I'm sorry, Magical Elves?
Magical Elves were the producers.
Okay.
They produced the first, what was the runway one? You know,
Project Runway.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was just imagining
yeah.
little elves.
And Andy Cohen and mm-hmm. everybody over at Bravo was part of Bravo. And they wanted me to be the Tim Gunn of this dance show.
Yes.
And, you know, they put a microphone on you and you're on the set from 8 a.m. until midnight every day. And they can get you at any minute. And what they do is they storyboard out their characters like they're storyboarding out a soap opera. And they slot you into the character you need to be for the show to have drama, because they make the drama out of tiring you out, keeping you around all day, having you mic'd, and waiting for you to explode.
And not
feeding you. Feeding you shit. So that's basically reality. That's reality TV.
Yeah.
So when I went to do Legally Blonde, Bravo wouldn't let me do Legally Blonde because I was under contract still. So I only could do like a total of 4 minutes in the whole series. So there was a whole negotiation about where would they use my 4 minutes,
right,
and how would they get me here and get me there, because they wanted me for the end and they had to have. So I was always off camera choosing the girls with Bernie and Heather and Paul Kanin. And I'm choosing with them, but I couldn't be on camera for a lot of it.
Fascinating. Yeah. Well,
that was interesting.
You know what?
I learned a lot.
We all learn a lot from these things that are unnatural to us to a certain degree. But I got ahead of myself because I was so excited because Legally Blonde, I could really sing the whole thing for you right now, but I won't. Because it's one of the greatest feminist musicals.
Well, Nell Benjamin and Larry, who wrote the music and lyrics, I mean, brilliant. Brilliant. And Heather, of course, who wrote the book. It was an amazing team to collaborate with for my first time as a director choreographer.
And Orfe was just here, actually. Yeah. And we got to talk about that.
It's been everywhere. And it keeps going in so many productions all over the world. And it's kind of amazing.
It's incredible. So somehow this thing happens where, because of the bike and the collarbone and the teacher and seeing your brilliance and her giving you the lessons, and it's all like Billy Elliot with a Michigan accent instead of Brit accents, it's understood in your family that this is what you do.
Yeah.
And this is, I would imagine, not what anyone else in your small town was doing.
No.
And you
we had a community theater. So.
But you said that when you were 10, you already knew you were gay, although you weren't talking about that.
Yes.
How do you know that?
Because everyone who's gay knows that.
Right.
They're gay. You know you're gay.
But did you have language for it and you weren't saying it? Or
no.
Did you just know
I just
something
knew.
Was
I
not?
I just knew that I liked boys more than I liked girls.
So you had that thought.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yes. And, you know, the funny thing about it is that I didn't come out to my family until I was 30.
Which
right.
Is,
and
yeah.
so, you know, I didn't grow up with Will and Grace. I didn't grow up with any gay role models.
Yeah.
Right. So you're living in a super small town where your biggest fear as a gay person living in that kind of environment is that everyone you love and you know loves you will no longer love you when you reveal your secret. That's why gay people don't come out. They're afraid of losing the love of the people that are most important to them. And a really, really great friend of mine, Leif Green, who was an actor at the time, he had come out to his family recently, and he had seen, I think, a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist gave him a book, and I don't remember the name of the guy who wrote it, but in it, the book was called Coming Out, An Act of Love.
Wait, a really good friend when you were 30?
No, not in high school. When I was 17 and 18, we were in the Young Americans together.
Okay.
But somewhere between 18 and 30, you know, he, of course, my friends all knew I was gay, but my family didn't. And he gave me a book called Coming Out, An Act of Love. I wish I knew the author's name. It was a doctor, psychologist.
All right. Easy to Google.
Easy, simple thing for you to do. A test, not a test, a routine for yourself.
Oh, okay.
You know, something. So draw a target and put circles, as many circles as you want in the target. Put in the center of the target on the bullseye the people who you love the most. And work out from the target and write in the names of the people you love less. So in the center of the target, I wrote my mom and dad and my brothers. And then I wrote relatives until I got to friends, until I got to strangers. And they said, start working your way towards the target. So you start telling the people in the outer circle, and then you work on the next circle, and then you work on the next circle. And when you realize nobody's dropping you, nobody's saying, oh, get the fuck out of my universe.
Or get off my bus.
You.
If you started with your bus driver, well, you get off here.
Yeah.
Right.
So you work your way in, and then you tell the people you matter most to. So I chose to write a very specific letter to my parents and my brothers. In the letter to my parents, I wrote a letter to both of my brothers. And the minute they got it, my father called me first. And my mother, and then my brothers. My brother said, I don't know if you're gay. I mean, I've always known you're gay. It's no big deal. You know, I mean, literally, it was no big deal. Of course, I was 30 by then, but it was, you know, it was, and my parents and family have always supported me and knew nothing about the career I was choosing for myself.
Right. I mean, it was such a foreign
nothing.
Thing.
Nothing. My father was a great, and still is, a musician. He played the accordion in a band when he was a kid in Chicago. He played for Sophie Tucker at the Palmer House.
Wow.
Yeah. He was he is an amazing accordion player. I would see my father. So I think I got some musicality from there because I would see him get up and play the accordion in our bar or at a wedding or something and literally turn the room on its ear. Everybody would be jumping and dancing and doing the polka. And, you know, it was crazy. I even put a polka in a show once because I was so inspired by those memories. Yeah.
So from the time you're 17, you come back, suddenly you're winning every track meet, even though you haven't been in school all year.
Yeah.
And then you go off to college.
Yes.
And now you're like, I want to dance. I love dancing. And this is what I want to do. Or were you going off to college?
I loved dance even in school. And I was choreographing the plays at the Village Playhouse and for the school. And then I apprenticed at the Hope Summer Repertory Theater in Holland, Michigan. And I met a lot of young actors who were seniors in college and different universities. I applied to those schools. I got accepted to Webster University and got a scholarship for the conservatory. And that's where I went.
Do you sing also?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to sing a little?
No, not really. I do sing, but I sang today.
Okay.
So I went to Webster. I went to Webster and I was in the conservatory. Freshman year, I got my equity card at the Muni Opera. Sophomore year.
Huge. By the way, no small thing. That must have been a great day.
It was incredible and did that whole summer thing. And then went back for my sophomore year. And Tony Stevens, God bless him, who's gone, great choreographer, was coming through town. And I auditioned for a Dr. Pepper commercial. I'm a Pepper, you're a Pepper.
Yeah,
wouldn't you like to be a Pepper?
I would.
Got a Dr. Pepper commercial.
National
commercial with David Naughton. The Pepper guy.
Okay.
I think, who was the werewolf, remember?
Yes.
So I'm in this commercial with him, and I have to join SAG, of course. And then I start getting checks. Now, I'm in college, right? So
yeah.
I'm getting these residual checks, and I'm going, wow. Banking the checks, spring break comes. My friends who I met at the Muni say, come to New York for spring break. I've never been to New York. I come to New York. I hang out with them for a week. They're going to an audition because they all have equity cards. They say, you've got an equity card. Come with us. Okay. Put on my clothes. Go to audition for Brigadoon for Agnes DeMille. One audition, and I get a Broadway show. And they didn't get it. I got a Broadway show. Go back to school. I said, I got a Broadway show. They said,
right. We'll
give you credit for your junior year to go do the Broadway show.
You just have to take one government class.
The show is supposed to start in September.
Unbelievable.
Michael Bennett and Bob Avian come through town with a tour of Chorus Line. And I go to the Fox in St. Louis and audition for that, I get that. So I go on tour all summer after my sophomore year in a Chorus Line. And then I leave a Chorus Line and come to Broadway to do Brigadoon. Brigadoon closes. My dad comes to the closing week because they had the bar. My mom came to the open. My dad comes to the closing. Let me drive you back to school. Well, Dad, I'm going to stay for 2 weeks and see what happens. I got to audition because I got to either sink or swim. The next day I go to an open call for Swings for Woman of the Year with Lauren Bacall. I get Woman of the Year. I go into Woman of the Year. School says, we'll let you finish the year.
Of course they do.
6 months to the day, I signed a six-month contract. I book the Best Lure House in Texas, the film, with Tony Stevens choreographing. I go out to Hollywood and make the Best Lure House in Texas. And I call school and say, I'm not coming back. I'm working now. Now I'm in. I'm in. And I come back to New York. And I get show after show after show, television, Broadway, whatever. And I'm working and dancing and working with choreographers. And, you know, the rest just took off and I did what I did. And then eventually when I won a Tony Award for Lacage, the college invited me back and gave me an honorary degree. So my parents got to see me get a degree. Because it was a big thing to leave college for my family because no one went to college. My brothers didn't go. And I was on a full scholarship. So it was a big thing to give that up.
Okay, that is a whirlwind.
Yeah.
Was it heaven?
It was the same as my energy. You know, my energy is like, whew, whew, whew.
Yeah.
And when I think about it, the energy, the way things came and the way I went, the energies sort of matched each other. Whew, whew, whew. You know, it was always moving at a fast clip.
I mean, I think about so much when I met you, it was when I auditioned for You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And And I feel like I want to say thank you.
Well, it was amazing.
I remember two things. I remember when I got cast in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, thinking, there's been a terrible mistake here. And I spent every audition saying, you guys know I don't do this, right? Like, really, this is so nice of you. I love hanging out with you guys, and I can't wait to see the show when you open, was sort of my experience.
Well, Michael Mayer, who was the director and is quite brilliant,
yes.
And Andrew Lippa, who did the new songs and was the musical director. Andrew and I had met doing Broadway Bears. And Michael actually saw a production of Follies that I choreographed at the Paper Mill Playhouse with Ann Miller. And he asked me after he saw that production and saw my work in that production. And, you know, the show, Charlie Brown, as I remember it, and David did the set.
David Gallo.
And the set was, wow,
yep.
Bright, and the way it moved. And it was such an exciting thing for me to do as a first show because it was simple. It was small cast. And working with Andrew and watching Michael work and learning from him, you know, we took a shot. And it was one of the greatest experiences of my life.
I think we all feel that way.
Got my foot in the door.
Definitely.
You know? I wanted to be a choreographer when I was 25, but I didn't get that opportunity until I was 40. Right?
That's crazy.
I was 40 when I choreographed my first Broadway show. And the process was, when I was 25, it was 85, and AIDS was killing everybody off. And I always say this, that dance is innately a sexual expression. And I think choreography sort of fell out of shows because people were afraid of the physical contact.
Yeah.
And I think it affected musicals because we went into the whole British sung musical. And, you know, Les Mis didn't even have a choreographer listed. And these shows were coming in that really didn't express themselves physically. And then suddenly it started to pick up again. And now look, 13 musicals, 12 musicals, 11 musicals, all new. Numerous fabulous choreographers working, young, a whole nother generation of choreographers who are becoming choreographer directors working on Broadway. And, you know, it's sort of rebirthed itself. But the AIDS crisis, I think, hit it in a way that we weren't even aware of when it happened.
That's really interesting. It's a really interesting way to look at it. When Billy Porter won his Tony for Kinky Boots after you won and gave like the most beautiful speech. And I felt like it was really, I mean, you've been up there before, but it was really a way for people to get to know you in that moment fully. He talked about you bringing an old friend along for the ride. How did you and Billy know each other?
When Billy was 19, I was choreographing one of my first shows out of town. It was called Heart's Desire. And Jody Mocha was working with me as my associate, and she knew Billy from Pittsburgh, from Danny Herman. And so she said, let's call Billy and he'd be great for this. Billy came in and auditioned for us, and I offered him the part. He was still at Point Park in Pittsburgh, I think, in school.
Okay.
And he decided, or Carnegie Mellon, he was at Carnegie Mellon. He went back to school. He wanted to go back to school and finish school. And I said, go do it. Well, then we met up on Grease. I was Jeff Calhoun's associate on Grease. And Billy, we cast Billy as the teen angel. And Billy and I became friends. And we socially knew each other, but we worked together then. And then we stayed in touch. He did a lot of Broadway Bears. He came out with his own album. He had won Star Search. He performed in Broadway Bears for me. And then he went off to write and start directing and working with directors because, as he says, he couldn't find roles that he thought were worthy of his attention. And then we were working on the show, and I said, Billy, I want you to... He had written me, but I was thinking about him, and I said, you come and read this. And I did a very, very quiet reading, and Harvey read Charlie that day.
Oh.
Because we didn't have a Charlie yet. And Billy read Lola, and Danny Sherman came in and read Don. And that was the first time.
And was this just you guys sitting around a table?
Just a table, just sitting around a table, not singing anything, just reading. And we played the songs as we knew them. And, you know, everybody left. And I said, I told you, that's Lola. That is Lola. And so we stuck with Billy through the other readings. And then you know, he got the part.
Did you have to fight for him? Was there a moment where they wanted a star, or was it just so obvious?
I didn't have to fight for him, but it was, I had to convince a few people that he was it. Mm-hmm. And trust me on this, right? And Stark Sands, who was my first choice for Charlie, couldn't do a couple of the readings because he was doing a TV series. But I wanted Stark. I wanted Stark. And I kept saying, it's Stark Sands. It's Stark. I'm telling you, it's Stark. Finally, Stark came in and he read two scenes and sang a song for us. He walked out of the room and I went, and they said, yes. And it was done.
You know, a lot of my guests tell really horrifying audition stories that are funny now.
Yeah.
And at the time, they were ready to go back to Kansas because
Yeah.
they were so mortified. Have you ever had it happen where you so believed in someone and you bring them in and they don't knock it out of the park, or
Yeah.
some version of that?
Yes. Yes, definitely. It happens a lot. I've been fortunate. That hasn't happened to me in leading role as much as it's happened in little smaller bit parts.
Right.
But the thing is that you have to find, you may think it works, then you find it doesn't. And maybe it needs to go another direction. And you find a way to write it. That's
Yeah.
your job as a writer. Let's make this work. I mean, the actor isn't that bad. The
Right.
actor's really got some stuff going on for him. Let's work to their strengths, get rid of the stuff that maybe doesn't work for them, and write some stuff that does.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to, you know, it's a give and take.
Legally Blonde, was that the first time where you were part of
Oh,
the
yeah.
creating the piece?
There were no writers on Legally Blonde.
Well, how did you know how to do that? And were you scared?
Well, I'd already done seven musicals, eight musicals
Right.
with nine, I think nine musicals
Right.
I had done on Broadway
Okay.
with Michael Mayer, Jerry Zaks, many with Jack O'Brien.
So and, you love Jack O'Brien.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
We'll talk. That's a whole other chapter.
That's another
and
show.
Then, and then as an associate with Bob Avian, Michael Bennett, and Jerry Robbins.
Right.
So I grew up
in the room.
I grew up in the College of Musical Theater. I mean, I had the best teachers in the world, and I was a sponge all the time. Not only with them, but the whole process of the musical, right? And I was a swing when I was on stage in Woman of the Year and in Barnum. So I was working backstage as a swing and assistant, and I was learning all of the whole show, the whole picture, not just just not one track, but the whole track, and how Joe Layton put that together. And so I'm taking all that information and constantly processing it. So when Legally Blonde came along, Hal Luftig said, I want to talk to you about something, took me to a meeting. It was Mike, Kristen, Hal, and Dory. Now, Mike and Kristen gave me my first job as a choreographer and were about to give me my first job as a
Right.
director.
Because they produced Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and Hal's there, and Dory, and
Who's Dory?
Dory Berenstain,
Okay.
who I'm working on another project with.
Yes, but we'll
so
get to that.
They put the script down, and the movie script, not the Broadway script, the movie script, and they go, and the DVD, would you be, I said, oh, yeah. I can tell that story right now. That's a musical waiting to happen. I've been dumped. We've all been dumped like hell and then gone after what we really wanted
Yeah.
and found ourselves along that journey. I said,
Yeah.
that is, I'm ready to tell this musical. And so we started to look for authors. And a lot of people had sent in CDs to the producers of them doing versions, songs that they thought would fit into the Broadway musical based on the film. I said, don't tell me who they are. Put all the songs on one CD with lyric sheets and put them like A, composing team, B, composing team, C, composing team. They did. I went to the beach. I turned everything off. I listened to it over and over. And I came back and I said, it's Group C. And Group C happened to be Larry and Nell. And they got hired to write the show. And then we had to find a book writer. And we were looking. And Mike, I think, had said, did you see Freaky Friday, where it was Lindsay Lohan,
mm-hmm.
which Heather wrote the first script of that movie. And I went out and met her, and I read a movie she had written the night before I met her about sorority sisters. And I went, oh my God, this girl has the voice.
She knows what this is.
And I met her, and she walked to the table in a skirt with a little pink, a little blonde ponytail and a purse. And I went, are you Elle Woods? And she, and that was it. It was done. It was just done. I knew she could do it. And that was the process. And then we went to town. And so that whole process of writing was us all working together. You know, certainly they were doing the writing, and I was telling them how I could make it work on stage or couldn't make it work on stage and suggesting ways to change it up. But we did that whole process and they had written an amazing first act and we did a reading and everybody responded very positively. They went off to write the second act. The second act came in and it wasn't such a positive response from the producers. And I said, calm down. This is how we're going to solve it. I told Hal, rent a house in the Hamptons and we'll all go there for 2 weeks and I'll come out with a new second act. We all went to the Hamptons together. I cooked. Heather and I shopped in the morning, went to the gym. Larry and I were writing songs like mad. Heather would come back, write scenes. I would cook. And we'd sit down each night and read what we did and listen to what they did. And by the end of 2 weeks, we had a new second act and we were on our way. Boom.
That
was an amazing experience to learn that process of writing, working with the writers and how you can help guide what the finished product will be. And certainly that was what we did with Kinky Boots, Harvey and I and Sin. We worked very closely together.
Did you know Harvey or Cyndi Lauper before Kinky Boots?
Yeah, I had worked with Harvey on Hairspray and the Legally Blonde. Hairspray and the Lacage Revival.
Okay, of course,
And then Cyndi I knew from... I choreographed the gay games in New York City and Cyndi performed in them and I choreographed her with 50 drag queens. And then she asked me to do her video remake. And then she did Broadway Bears for me a couple times.
Was there ever a time from the time you were 17 until things really cooked for where you really struggled?
I feel like between the day I gave up dancing on Broadway till I got my first Broadway show, which was about a 14-year window, because I stopped dancing at 26.
Did you have an injury? Were you exhausted?
No, I just wanted to choreograph. I didn't want to perform anymore. So 26, I stopped really performing, and I was trying to get a Broadway show desperately, and maybe trying too hard. Mm-hmm. And then I had a big breakup with my first boyfriend, and I was 30. And I went back into the Will Rogers Follies. And I was still trying to get a Broadway show. And Tommy Toon, who did the show, Eric Shepard at ICM, who's no longer here, was working with Tommy Toon. And they wanted Tommy to do a movie, and Tommy didn't want to do it. And he said, talk to Jerry, I think was what happened. And after the show at 11:30, I was called to 750 7th Avenue to meet a producer and a director. And I went to 750 7th Avenue at about 11:30. They're doing a night shoot. I walk into the lobby of this building, and there's a big red Ferrari parked in the middle of the lobby. And I'm going, wow, what's going on? And I walk around the corner. I meet Ron Schwari and a director named Marty Brest, who I didn't know who he was. And they say, we're doing this scene and there's some dancing and the star isn't really comfortable and he wants us to cut it, but we don't want to cut it. Could you come and watch him take dance class tomorrow? And I said, sure. So they said, okay, here's the music. Listen to the music. So I go to dance class. I listen to the music. I walk in and Al Pacino is taking a tango lesson.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like... And they're going, and they're there too. And they go, see, he's not remembering anything. I said, he's not being taught choreography. He's being taught a lesson. There's a difference.
Sure.
I said, he's got to be taught a routine that he can repeat. That's the problem. So I started to routine the number. And in that afternoon, I did half of that dance in one afternoon. They said, can you come back tomorrow? I said, sure. Finished it the next day. Ron Schwari threw some cash in my hand and said, you have just saved my ass. And everybody was happy. And they made a deal to pay me, but he was so happy because literally he wanted to cut the scene because he wasn't learning. We did it. The rest is history. We filmed it, and it was done.
What? So that was your first movie
with Al Pacino. As a choreographer, yes. And so because of that because of that tango, Meryl Streep, The Object of One True Thing, The Object of My Affection, Meet Joe Black, In and Out. I mean, movie after movie after movie. Stars who had to dance in a little teeny scene but wanted a choreographer on set so they didn't look ridiculous.
Right, of course.
And the In and Out dance was fabulous with Kevin Kline, who was brilliant. You know, I just got these wonderful opportunities while I'm still waiting to get a Broadway show.
And also, the thing about you, which I know from personal experience, is I will never forget, and I could cry right now, as you took me aside and you said, Alana, I promise you, you will feel like a dancer. I will never let you look stupid.
I
will never let you. And I know you, if you did that for me, you certainly did it for Meryl Streep.
Michael Bennett taught me that when I was young. He said, if they look bad, you look worse. It's hard. You're vulnerable when you aren't a trained dancer and you're being asked to do a dance.
I know, but the other thing is I remember is you'd like, let me just show you. And you would literally do it. Like, you take the blanket and you swing it around and be like, can you just do it? If you could come out every night just at this moment and put on the Lucy wig, that would be amazing. Also, I now understand, this is a long time ago now, that show, and knowing your winery roots, I remember on opening night coming into my dressing room, and it may not be a big deal now, but it was my first really expensive bottle of champagne. That was your, it was some Veuve. And
yes,
that was like, yes. And I just was like, okay, I'm sure and then I looked, it wasn't from the producers. It was from you. And I will never forget that. And I have made that my tradition for opening night gifts. Like, that's a nice gift.
It's a great gift.
It's a good, and it never, never goes out of style.
No, nope.
So you have really been able to take the lessons and the gifts that your mentors gave you when you talk about Michael Bennett and Bob Avian and Jerome Robbins and all of the, and Jack O'Brien and all of these people who you watched and admired and then were able to kind of take their style and then blend it with your warmth and style. Kinky Boots obviously has become an international sensation.
Yeah, kind of crazy.
It's incredible because it is one of the most complicated, simple stories, right?
You know, that's what's really interesting. I remember Marcia Mason, who's dear friends with Jack O'Brien, and I think she said, it's like peplum. It's like a necessary milk. And I'll never forget that because it's extremely simple.
Yeah.
But I always say that I think for me, what's that? The simplicity, the universal message. But I think everybody finds themselves either in the drag club version side of the story or in the factory side of the story. And, you know, the character Don, Danny Sherman's character, the bully, there are a lot of men who see him and go, well, if he can put on the kinky boots, then so can I. So they end up in a very happy place at the end because they think, well, it was painless. And it's propelled by Harvey's book, but Cindy's incredibly infectious score. So that's a big, big plus.
Yeah. So what are you doing now?
So now I'm working with another great team, Jim Valance and Brian Adams, songwriters, and J.F. Lawton, and God bless him, Gary Marshall, who was with us till the very last year on the Broadway musical Pretty Woman.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So that's getting that ready for Broadway.
Wow.
And it's very exciting. Very exciting. Great team, great collaboration, great writers. I actually, when I saw the movie, when it came out, 26 years ago, I was looking for a Broadway show as a choreographer, and I tried to get the rights to it.
Are you serious?
I went to Mark Sindroff, and I said, I want to turn this into a musical. Of course, I tried that with Hairspray, too. I was a nobody, so everybody just laughed, right? So that didn't happen. Brian Adams, it turns out, tried to get the rights to it or talked with Disney at the time, Touchstone. He couldn't do it. So JF and Gary both had the possibility, and it was Paula Wagner, the producer, who brought them together and shepherded this whole idea. And then we met, and I said, look, the thing, and Brian wasn't involved yet, and I said, it needs an original score. That's what, when you take a movie and you bring it to the stage, there's one new element you can add that wasn't in the film, and that's an original score.
Mm-hmm.
And Legally Blonde had it, Kinky Boots had it, and now Pretty Woman will have it. And that's the thing that makes it a musical, you know? And if I were doing a ballet of Pretty Woman, then I'd probably have a ballet composer compose a ballet. But, you know, the element that you're bringing to the musical is the new score. And that's what's exciting about it.
So are you like hauled up in the Hamptons in a house, and are you cooking, and where are you guys doing
it? Well, Brian, like Cindy on Kinky, has a responsibility to tour because of their record. He's going on tour all the time. So we work mostly around his schedule, but also my schedule. I'm crazy busy, and JF's busy in LA. So we find blocks of time to get together and write, and we work and write. And then, so now we're here in New York doing a 3-week reading. And then we have another one planned in the fall. And then sometime next year, we'll be going into production to come into Broadway.
So are there already stars attached to the
show? No.
You're just bringing in people to kind of flesh it out.
We're really
you.
Not there yet. I'm really working on the structure. I like to get the structure right first.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, if you had like a box with a necklace and you open the box,
yes.
And like, and then you handed it to me, and then I like put my hand in,
and
then
go.
You.
That will be in the show.
That's iconic.
I mean, there are things there. You know, the funny thing about a musical that's such a, it's dangerous. It's an iconic film, but ultimately, it's a Cinderella story.
Totally.
And there's something really powerful about that still today. And
are you adapting it? Do you feel in certain ways to
yes,
mesh
yes,
with the times we
yes.
live in?
I want it to be.
So it's a Cinderfella story?
I want it to exist in a timeless period, right? I don't want to bring cell phones out and all that crap.
Yeah.
It's not necessary, not for the story. It's a romance. It's a romantic story. And so, yeah. But there are things in the film that I want to honor, and certainly things that Gary brilliantly did. And I've been such a fan of Gary
sure.
Marshall's my whole life.
Sure.
I grew up on Gary Marshall television and movies. And so it's and to have spent a year and a half with him, JF and Gary and I and the boys, Jim and Brian, we all finished a draft before Gary passed.
That's great.
And Gary had this calendar, and Heather, his associate producer who works with him, she told me about this, and he had... And it's all in hand writing, right? And on the days, there were big W's on the day in the calendar. W, big W, big W, big W. And once in a while, a little L. And I said, well, what do those represent? Win. These are days that were won. These are win days. And the L was a lose day. That was the day he lost a softball game. But I mean, Gary was such a positive guy and a funny guy. And the experience of watching him always try to find the humor and the heart in the piece, that's what I love. And that's what I believe in too.
So at the end of, you know, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Gene Wilder says something like, you know what happens to the boy who got everything he wanted? He lives happily ever after.
Yeah.
Where are you with that right now?
I'm very fortunate. I have a great partner, Ricky Schroeder, and
he's really cute.
We have
and
a
talented.
Great and very talented, and we have a beautiful new home, and we have a pretty good life, and we're just you know, doing what we love to do, and very fortunate and blessed, and feel great about that. I've got goals. I'm going to do the Bye Bye Birdie with Jennifer Lopez, and they asked me to come back as director choreographer, which I'm really excited about. So to be able to direct and choreograph one of these live musicals for television is certainly a thrilling, exciting thing. I have choreographed a lot of films. I'm in the process of reading some films as a director of a film, which is something I would love to take a shot at.
Or would you be interested in a non-musical film as well at this point?
I'd be interested in any film that I thought I could definitely tell the story,
yeah.
Right? I don't want to do a film that I can't tell the story, that I don't feel like I can actually control this story. And as you know, what's the point of doing anything if you don't want to be there 24/7? Because you're going to be there 24/7. That's the greatest thing about our lives is, I feel, or my life personally, is that in all of this time, 30 some years, I don't really feel like I've worked. To be able to get up and go do what I do and go at 8 in the morning and come back at 10 and say, I'm going to do it again tomorrow, and it doesn't feel like work,
mm-hmm.
is kind of the most amazing blessing. I have great family, you know, so I have a lot of great things in my life. The biggest thing is like taking care of the dancer aches, you know, oh, my back, oh,
yeah.
my knee, oh, my shoulder, oh, my this. It's like, you know, the all of the years of turning out is starting to catch up with me. My brothers have both had hip replacements, and I go, oh, don't tell me I'm next. Are we the Golden Retriever family? We probably are. So, you know, that's like, you know, how do you keep up?
Well, you're doing all right.
Thank
you're
you.
Doing just fine. Jerry
you
Mitchell.
Too.
You too. This was incredible.
Thank you for having me.
It was my pleasure.
Clouds can make the wind blow.
If you want more information about my guests, go to the website littleknownfactspodcast.com. I also wanted to tell you that there is now a new addition to the website. It is a button that says contributions. This podcast is a true labor of love, and I really, really want to keep doing it for a long time. So if you like listening as much as I love to do it, please feel free to contribute. It would mean the world to me. Also, on Twitter, you can find me at Alana Levine. Instagram is Little Known Facts Podcast. And on Facebook, Little Known Facts Podcast. You can also feel free to rate and review the show on the iTunes show page. This podcast is recorded at Hanger Studios in New York City. This episode was brought to you by Pro Media. Located in Times Square, Pro Media offers both production and post-production services out of its beautiful studios in the heart of New York City. Pro Media, sound vision. Find out more at promedia.nyc.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.